So thank you all for coming today. I wanted to welcome you to the April session of the Intel Hub, where today we have Randolph Fierson joining us. Randy is CEO of Globalytica. He is the president of Fierson Associates and a founding director of the nonprofit Forum Foundation for Analytic Excellence. He teaches advanced analytic techniques and critical thinking skills to government and private sector analysts in the United States and abroad. Mr. Fierson has authored or co-authored 11 books to include Structured Analytic Techniques for Intelligence Analysis, now in its second edition, Critical Thinking for Strategic Intelligence, also in its second edition, Analyst's Briefing Guide, Analyst's Guide to Indicators. He also recently edited and published Richard J. Heuer Jr.'s memoir, Rethinking Intelligence. Mr. Fierson holds a patent on a suite of collaborative analytic tools called ThinkSuite. He was a career CIA intelligence analyst and manager, last serving as National Intelligence Officer for Latin America. Mr. Fierson is the recipient of the Distinguished Intelligence Medal for his service as NIO and the Distinguished Career Intelligence Medal. He received his AB from Dartmouth College and his MA in international relations from Yale University. Randy, thank you for joining us, and I'm looking forward to your presentation today on Rethinking Intelligence, and I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you. Everyone, I believe Randy is going to be taking questions. He'll let you know when he's ready for his questions. He's got a lot of content to get through, and I will be monitoring the chat to make sure nobody gets any of their questions missed. So, Randy, without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Nicole. Thank you for that very nice introduction. I find it exciting to be able to work on or present on this webinar to a distinguished group of people, many of whom I know. What I wanted to do was to basically organize my little chat around a book that we recently published. Dick Heuer came to me over a year ago, and as he was approaching his 90th birthday, he has decided to write a memoir for his family. It was around a 200-page memoir, and he asked if I could edit it so it would look good and look sharp for his family. I started to read it around a year ago, and I said, this is absolutely fascinating. The first 100 pages was his early life, and there were all kinds of tidbits there. But even more significant was in his professional life. There was really a chapter on foundational issues that we work with every day in the intel community, looking at work he did early on with deception, also with the Nosenko affair and ACH as a technique, the work he did with Kahneman on cognitive bias, and then more recently work we've done together on structured analytical techniques, and lastly work he's done on security and security issues with Persirec. And as I looked at this, I said, most people coming into the workforce today probably are taking a lot of this for granted, and they don't know the roots of what happened and how all these things got started. So what I was going to do today is kind of go through those topics and just briefly and talk about some of what I find is what is relevant about what he was doing decades ago and how it's really had a major impact on how we do analysis and how we work in the intelligence community. As I go through each topic, I think I'll stop and ask if there's any questions before I jump to the next issue. So let me start. There we go. So there's Dick, and that's the book. And it's available on, we have it on our website if anybody is interested in it for, as an ebook. But what I found fascinating to start off with was work that he did on deception, where we developed the mom, pop, Moses, and Eve process, which is an easy one to remember. And if you go through how do you know you're being deceived, you look at the motives, the opportunities, and the means of the adversary, the deceiver, what their past reputation is in terms of trying to deceive you, how easily they can manipulate sources that you'd be reading and processing, and lastly, a really robust checklist on how to know if the thing or the document you're looking at is deceptive. And what really struck me as I was editing the book was this is extremely important today for looking at how we deal with fake news and false narratives. And in fact, I think you can see how we've gone from a manageable problem with deception to what is now, I call it the scourge of the next decade, where we haven't figured out how to deal with the false narratives that are being published, knowing what's true and not true, And a lot of what Dick has in his deception checklist related directly to that. You've got very strong motives and immense opportunities now. Instead of in the old days, you put an article in a newspaper and try to influence an Italian election, you could reach hundreds of people. Today, you could post something on the internet and reach millions immediately. So the means and the opportunity to put out false narrative is immense. We also have a certain country which is quite adept at doing it, going back to their active measures activities many years ago, and others who have learned quite quickly, including teenagers in Macedonia, who can just pop in and develop very effective false narratives. They have a huge ability to manipulate their sources. And generally, what I also think is important with what Dick has done is that we have tools and techniques and checklists looking at how to, and actually my Canadian friends have done a really good checklist that I published on how to evaluate the quality of the information you're receiving, particularly on the internet. So this is an issue where I think in the next couple of years, we have to figure out how to deal with it. If we don't, we could be facing a major intellectual collapse across the world, as nobody knows what to believe and how what they can believe and what they can't believe. And what I find curious is that it goes way back to how we've been trying to deal with this for many times. So I was going to say, if anybody has any questions on this, I'll take a look at them and maybe answer them.
Looks like Kathy is currently typing in the chat, so we'll see if she's got a question. Nope, I don't think so. Looks like George is typing, so we'll see what we've got. Just some greetings. All right, I think, Randy, you're good to go. Okay. If we need to circle right back, we can.
Okay, we can catch up that later. One of the key things about why the false narrative issue is so powerful today, I believe, is that they've understood that they know how to deal with our cognitive biases, and confirmation bias in particular is a very powerful thing. Dick, when he was working at the CIA on methodology, doing a lot of empirical work, was approached by an academic in Israel who said, Dick, you're looking too much at numbers. You need to be thinking about the brain. And he then introduced Dick to Kahneman and Tversky, and they started a conversation. And Dick then did his seminal work, Psychology of Intelligence Analysis, looking at cognitive bias and how it impacts on our analytical process. And what I think we've learned and we've developed as an art and really integrated into most of our training and most of our work is the kinds of cognitive biases that we are focusing on and how we need to resist them and try to mitigate them, although we know we can't totally avoid them. What I'd like to describe, for example, when you go back to fake news and cognitive bias, if you have the question is who's going to set the narrative. Who's going to, if you look at political campaigns, a person running for office will try immediately to try to set a narrative and say, this is who I am, and set a false or a bad narrative for their opponent. And if you decide you like that narrative and you click on to that person and say, I think I'll vote for him or her, you'll find that everything that they say you're starting to like, things that you don't like that they say you kind of forget, and everything that the opponent says you think is wrong. So you start reconfirming your bias and you lock yourself in. And if you can get to the right people at the right time, you can lock them in very quickly. And I think what's happening now with a lot of what the Russian trolls are doing is finding that magic moment when people are trying to decide what's going on, getting to them with information that they find compelling, which plays to a lot of their other cognitive biases. And then once they have you, then they're going to keep you. Confirmation bias will keep you there. So that plays and it's very powerful. It is also premature closure. They anchor you on certain things that could be false, and they manage to manipulate how you think and what you're trying to do. The problem and the critical problem is that once you've decided this is how I'm going to think about something, it's very hard to get you to change your mind. So you're extremely resistant to change. We've seen that at least in the United States with the Trump voters. They're there, and they're going to stay there no matter what the data is. And we've seen that in other parts of Europe as well. They also, you tend not to see anything else that's outside the framework that you have. So if it doesn't fit into your framework, you're going to ignore it. And there could be, you can say it's noise when it turns out that it's really a signal. So trying to get you to focus on inconsistent data or outlier data is much more difficult. So what you've seen, I think, is a problem that as we look at our analytical process, that we need to be much more cognizant of what we're doing. And this is actually will take me later on to why we've developed SATs, structured techniques, because being sensitive, as Dick says, being sensitive to the biases doesn't really solve a problem. You need to have a process or a structure or rigor or a systematic mechanism that allows you to protect yourself from what you're doing. And that's what we've done as we moved into the SAT world. So to make the next point, a critical SAT that Dick developed was within the Senko case. He was watching a Russian defector who had incredibly good information arrive in the United States, and half of the intelligence community in the United States thought that he was a Russian agent or a double agent being planted to deceive us. And they had arguments over arguments for almost a year as to can we trust what this person is telling us, Yuri Nisenko, or are we being deceived and are we being taken to the cleaners by the Soviets? And Dick was watching everybody build their arguments, and he said, there's got to be a better way to resolve this. So he flipped the idea, and he said, what is all the information that would be inconsistent with him being a defector, and what's the information that would be inconsistent with him being a Russian agent? And one of the big arguments was this guy had a lot of information and he had a lot of access when he left, and he also didn't have much of a feedback loop to go back and talk to the Russians. So both of those inconsistent data facts argued against him being a Russian agent. What's curious, what I didn't realize until I edited the book, is that initially Dick voted to say that he thought he was a Russian agent. So he didn't begin thinking that he was possibly a true defector. And it's only around a year later when he got involved more deeply in the case that he said there's a 30% chance he really could be a legitimate defector, did a little bit more research, and then actually developed three different techniques. And all those techniques, as applied by the counterintelligence people, showed that he probably was a true defector and he could be trusted with what he's telling us. So that ACH technique, I found, kind of went into military intelligence, counterintelligence, and died for many years until 9/11, or just before 9/11. I started to teach it at CIA because I thought it was very powerful. And Dick and I worked with the Palo Alto Research Center to get it put on a computer. And that made a huge difference. That once it was not a cumbersome mechanism, but something that you could just pop in, put in your data, and play with it, it was much more powerful. And generally, it's caught on after that from the last 15 years now. It's moved up to be one of the premier techniques that people use in a group of maybe five or six that they rely on a lot. What scares me with this technique as it's evolved is that a lot of people misuse it, and they want to count up the consistency or give points to the consistency, which is exactly not what to do. This is a tool that basically trolls for inconsistency, and it gets you two-thirds of the way there, but you can't use that as a predictive tool. And you can't use it as a definitive analysis. It tells you what to avoid, and it allows you to think through all of your assumptions and all your problems and organize your data. And now that it's being used, I think Dick gets a lot of credit for having thought through all this and put it together. So let me stop there and see if we have any questions here.
Yeah, Randy, I see a question in the chat from Matt Crofton. I know millennials are quite progressive in using sites like Snopes to debunk fake news. Would it be advisable to create a larger, more powerful version of Snopes, something that might include marketing and branding to get the public aware and adoptive of the technology, specifically aimed at disinformation campaigns run by other countries and actors?
I think this is the direction we have to move in. I gave a presentation a couple of weeks ago at the International Studies Association saying, how do we solve the problem? And a parallel idea is if we could actually build like a trust box in the cloud, and people who want to know that there's validated information only in that trust box, and that they can draw their information from that box, they have trusted, reliable sources, they have peer-reviewed and validated articles, et cetera. I think most of us, and this has already begun, and there are many examples of that commercially already, where people are putting together repositories of things that you can believe in and trying to work that way. I don't think you can get the world to only deal with trusted information because they're going to believe what they want to believe. But those of us, which hopefully aren't a minority of the world, who want to have reason-based information, evidence-based discussion, I think we're going to start moving toward that environment where there are places to go to get your information. Ideally, over time, you basically only pull your information from these trusted locations. The critical issue is, though, is who decides if it's trusted or not trusted. And for those of us in the intelligence analysis field, maybe we could have a really good side job, you know, getting 5 or 6 articles a day, pay us $10 an article and say, yeah, this is good, this is bad, because we understand sourcing, we understand what to look for, and you could probably clean up 2/3 of the data. There's another third that's probably not worth worrying about and moving in that direction, but I think he has a very good idea for what we have to do. Okay, so let's see if I have any more questions yet.
Let me go on. Yeah, go ahead and go forward. Go ahead and move on, Randy, and I'll keep note of the chat.
Okay. So that take me to the structural analytical techniques. And as we've looked at this issue, we realized, well, one other point on the what we've tried to do is to expand the cognitive bias issue by adding a whole new area of intuitive traps, things that analysts tend to do that are mistakes. And they're a little bit less highfalutin, but they are probably just as frequently an error that we create and we make. Things like assuming that the next case you're working on in law enforcement is like the last case you worked on, or projecting your past experiences forward, or assuming there's only one solution to the problem, or not contemplating that there could be an alternative explanation for what's going on. Actually, what I see constantly on the pundits on TV and radio is saying, imposing patterns on a system and trying to say, well, I think this is happening because there's this, 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 and that, and there's a grand strategy there when probably there's nothing. So you have to deal with, you know, a lot of these techniques and these errors that we make. And the best way to do that, we think, is to employ some structured techniques. So we put together our book. I'll be updating this book this fall, or actually over Christmas vacation, and we're going to publish a third edition of the SAT book. I'm going to probably drop 5 techniques, add 5 techniques. Anybody who wants to drop me an email and suggest what should go into the book or could come out would be great. One thing I know I'm probably going to take out is anything that deals with contrarian devil's advocacy. I'm going to make a case that those basically emotion-leading techniques are really counterproductive. And I've been downplaying them, but I think now I'm going to eliminate them from the handbook. So as you look at the SATs, I wanted to put them in context for what Dick has done and what I have done. And we go back to Kahneman's work of System 1, System 2 thinking, and we have the traditional analysis and the intuitive thinking in System 1. And I make the point that that can be very powerful and very correct if you have a large N, a large population of observations. So if you're a flight attendant and you're trying to see if someone's hooked up their seatbelt or not, 80% of the time the flight attendants tell me they don't even look at someone's lap. They can just look at their eyes and they can tell if they have to or don't have to. And they say 80% of the time they guess right. They've got a very good intuition because they've had 100,000 opportunities to test what they're doing. We live in a world of System 2 thinking, which is looking at analysis, and it's slow, it's more rigorous. And what we did is try to define SATs in that context based upon whether you're dealing with qualitative or quantitative data and whether most of the data is available or not available. So if you move to expert judgment, we're saying this is really critical thinking skills in what you're trying to do. And you take your data, you process it, and you have techniques and argumentation, and you present it. Or if you have empirical analysis, you have a lot of data, you have computers, you can run an algorithm and you can have your data there. If you go down to quasi-quantitative, you can build a model of how things operate, and then you can populate the model with data and with expert judgment. And we did that, or I did that for military coups, and we also did it for political instability. Bush, Brennan, and Mosquito did it for electoral politics. And these models are about 80% accurate in their predictive capacity. And what amazes me is how they haven't really caught on as major thought tools to push analysis forward, which then leaves me with the other box where you don't have all your data and you don't have many computers and you're trying to just figure out what's going on. And we've developed 4 families of innovative diagnostic reframing and strategic foresight tools. So I didn't think that was going to happen. So these or actually I think when we do the next book, we're going to organize the tools around this area. Where we're focused, diagnostic is where... There we go, I got it. So looking at the innovative techniques or creative techniques, brainstorming, diagnostic would be ACH, reframing would be something like the premortem analysis, then strategic foresight techniques. So these are the way, oops, I didn't mean to do that, the way we've organized it. So maybe, let's see, do we have any more questions? Okay, so let me go on to the next. All right, do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you, Randy.
Okay, good. So as I was working through the book, the other thing that caught my attention is Dick actually has been working in the security area for a long, long time. Actually, my wife, who was running the analysis division in the Office of Security at CIA, had actually hired him as a consultant to do a lot of work for her on how to think about security issues. And he, many decades ago, he did a empirical analysis of American spies and looked at their character attributes as to what they found and what they shared, mostly focusing on, because of the Cold War, people who were spying for the Russians. And in essence, he built a checklist of what the Russians had been successful in exploiting, what they're looking for, the kinds of targets they go after, and these are the people who they have been successful in recruiting who have these seven attributes. So we wrote this up in the book as well, and I thought that it was quite an interesting list, and it has some real-world relevance today as you go down this list as to why there'd be concern and why I think we had some major briefings given right at the start of the current administration as to the kinds of people that are most susceptible to the Russian operations over the last 3 or 4 decades. So I'll leave it to you to do an analysis of the list, but I found it a fascinating little insight, which does raise the point that I did a detailed discussion of this on a blog that I publish once a month. And if you go to my website, you can pick it up and you can go back in the archive and see a longer analysis of this. But it's an example of where Dick had quite a wide range of work that he did across, quite many, touched many of the core areas of the kinds of analysis we're trying to do and how to do it better. And in many ways, he took what was being done, and I like the idea he rethought it or he reinvented it, and he made us rethink it, and it comes down to finding out a way that you can bring a systematic and rigorous process into the work you're doing that also then gives you transparency for how you're doing your work. You can audit your activity. If you're right or if you're wrong, you can go back and see why. And lastly, what he and I have both worked very hard to stress is in the future, good analysis will definitely require that you work more and more as small teams, that in order to avoid some of these traps and avoid the cognitive biases, you can't really see your own bad assumptions. You can't challenge yourself on assumptions. You need someone else to say, why did you say that? What's going on? So if you pull in other people's experience and when you begin the conceptualization of your products, you're going to be a lot better off. You have a richer base to begin with. And then if you can use them to basically second guess you, mostly in the conceptual parts of the process, you're going to be much better off. We've kind of, as we've worked, Dick and I have worked on all these issues, there are two techniques, I'll sum up with this, that we think almost anybody, everybody should use in almost any product they work on, no matter what their area of activity. The first is building a culture of just knowing what assumptions you're making and having someone to challenge those assumptions for you and to keep that known. We found that 1 out of 4 assumptions we make, which we thought were solid when we put them down, turn out to be to collapse on really critical inspection. And you don't want to build an analytical model or an analytical process based upon 1/4 of your foundation that is faulty. So it's very important to look at those assumptions The other thing that we've been stressing is work that has been done with Gary Klein on the premortem, and the idea that if you come to closure on what you want to write, what you're going to say, or how you're going to present an argument, right before you do the hard work of building the deck or writing the paper and filling it out, you need to go back and say, is there any way I could be spectacularly wrong? Is there anything I did? Did I use bad sourcing? Did I have a bad assumption? Did I ignore the fact that there's a neat gap in my evidence base? You know, if you had, and it's just one example, that I've never finished a day and turned off my computer and said, gee, was there something here that I didn't see that I should have seen today? I'm too busy trying to go home and get dinner. So, but if I had a list that says, these are five things to ask yourself before you shut down and to contemplate, then I probably would ask myself that question or think about it. So if you have a process or structured process that allows you just to check your biases and your assumptions and organize what you're doing and then go back and review them rigorously, you're going to have a far better product. And I guess my last point is all of these things that we've worked on, that we talked about here, are things that if you pay attention to them and you integrate them into your, make them habits of your thinking, you're going to find that your work becomes a lot faster and you actually save a lot of time over time as you go through the process. So I think I'll stop there and see if anybody has questions they want to ask.
Perfect, Randy. I see Matt Crossan's got some comments and a question. Randy, you made a great point about how people in general seem to be quite attached to their own biases. In media analysis, that has caused a great debate about modern users of technology. In short, do people alter their opinions with obtained information, or do they only seek out information based on their biases? I ask this because it seems like the problem you're trying to overcome is more difficult if people aren't just resistant to changing their biases, but actually seek out information to further concretize their biases. If that's true, how do you break that dilemma down? Can improved SATs really tackle that disturbing societal trend?
Well, actually, I totally agree. There's really a double whammy there. We have a society that's increasingly willing to only talk to people they're comfortable talking to. I think the real driver behind that phenomenon, actually within my family, let's say we have very different views and very different opinions, and people believe them fervently, and I suspect that half of that belief factor is based on having absorbed and accepted false news and fake information, which really isn't validated. You say, well, why do you believe that? And they say, well, I just, in my gut, I think that he or she just can't be trusted. You say, well, what do you disagree with on the policy? And they don't have an answer. And my suspicion is that it's the fake news that is really corrosive in trying to build on your biases and make it harder and harder to then be more evidence-based when you have your conversations and discussions. I think, to be honest, that this is a societal problem. And as we move forward, we're going to have almost a societal awakening to the fact that what's corrosive and what's happening here, that society doesn't insist that there is we're at a tipping point today, and you actually see some politicians who make the case, I'll just tell you what I want you to believe, whether it's true or not. If I repeat it long enough, then I can make it true. And that's a very dangerous way to proceed. And society is going to accept that, and it makes them comfortable to hear what they want to hear, and they don't question anything, and there is no, absolutely, we move to a case where there's no longer any absolute truth. It's just whatever perception is most, has the biggest impact on you. Then we're getting near the collapse of our civilization as we know it, not to understate it. So dealing with this is going to really require, I almost say, a social revolution, where people have said enough, well, we have an enough campaign already starting now. But there's a recognition, we have to learn a lot more about Cambridge Analytica. We have to learn a lot more about what happened with Brexit. I think we're going to learn a lot more about the U.S. elections and the French elections. And what Macron actually did, a very fascinating thing, where when he knew that he was being hacked when he was running for office, he then let them hack him, and then he fed bad news into the hackers. And so then when they wanted to do their big display 2 hours before they had to shut down all public announcements, they tried to go after him with these big displays of what they had hacked. And a lot of it was corrupt and was wrong. So he basically managed to make them look bad, not knowing that he'd double-crossed them with filling them with bad data. So those are some strategies you can use, but you need to get a public awareness that we want to really deal with good news and with accurate news. And there we have around a 10-year challenge working with three stools. You have to work with Amazon and Google and the others who are they have the money to work on this issue. And they have I think they're learning now that Zuckerman, that they have a social commitment. You also have to deal with academia and the people who understand what is solid information and what's not. And then you have really actually the Intel community who understands sourcing and understands what needs to be done. So if you can get those three together in a room, you can't really ask government to make sure that only truth is said, because then you're really heading right towards censorship in terms of who decides what needs to be done. So it really requires a social compact, but I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, Randy, you raised some interesting components also when you started talking about the need for small teams to kind of address problems, and it got me thinking about how there are, I've seen a number of cases where small teams were created poorly, so you almost need a sort of guide as well, you know, or a structured process as well for building a team to ensure that you're not stacking the deck in favor of one perspective or the other, because even if you have a small team and you fill it with yes men or women, you're still going to end up with a bad decision.
Yeah, absolutely right. And there are two things. Number one is that you need to have people who are quality analysts or understand what's happening. You need a mix of skills and a mix of actually intellectual attributes. You need the detail person and you need a conceptual person. You need to pull people who are good graphics artists, let's say. You need to define the attributes you want, put them together. There are programs, and I know a couple of people on the system here have done really good work on exactly that concept. There are three or four kinds of people we need in our organization. We're going to recruit all four so that when we have a project, we can pull somebody from each of those four categories, put them on a team, and we know that we're going to have a balanced team that brings you like, well, I can easily say you need the engineer as well as you need the analyst, and you need the data person, and you need the conceptualizer. So as you look at the kinds of attributes you want, you need to build those teams. In government, and it's been a little bit harder to do because they're so focused on the star player that there's only one person doing that thing, so you can't pick and choose. But it goes back to my bottom point is one of the things you really need almost any commercial or academic, or commercial or government, is somebody who's got significant empathy and understands what the client wants and what they're supposed to deliver. So I'm pushing on team building is to make sure at least you have a good empathizer who is looking beyond the specific task to what's the impact of what we're doing, how it would be received, and is this what people are really needing and looking for.
Randy Rubin makes an interesting comment in the chat. Maybe you can speak a little bit more towards it, that he notes that an interesting point from the memoir is to discover that Dick didn't start working on analytic methods right from the beginning, but he actually started out in Directorate of Operations.
Yes, because his background was working as an operations officer in Europe, and he was always of an academic tilt, but the fact that he had done so much work in operations, and particularly in counterintelligence, which is probably the most challenging of all the operational areas and analytical areas, it gave him a background and it gave him a much broader perspective. And it's a good example of having dealt with a very practical issues and how to work them. A lot of the SATs we found are directly applicable to ops work. If you're doing surveillance, you're looking at alternative hypotheses. You're actually developing indicators of what you expect them to do and what you don't expect them to do. So there are a lot of things as you get into the ops world that fit even more perfectly into a lot of the SATs we develop. So I think Dick had that background, but it's a classic example of a crossover where he was actually heading toward Berkeley to go get a PhD, and a friend of his who he left Europe, he was flying back, he stopped in Washington basically to check out, and a guy who gave him a ride to the agency said, "We're forming a new unit, called the Analytical Methods Unit, and maybe you'd want to work there and do some work there. And Dick said, that sounds fascinating. Canceled his plans to go get a PhD and took this job. It was purely as a lark. It was amazing that we would have had almost none of this richness if he hadn't just asked somebody for a ride. And the person he asked for a ride to get from Bethesda into Langley happened to know about this unit being formed, and then there's a long story from there on as to how it played out. But I think Dick's work in the operations side gave him a chance really to focus even also on human behavior. So when he started looking at the cognitive issues, he could see exactly how those fit in, also from the perspective of trying to manipulate people. And of course, his job was to deceive people. So these things played to his strengths. And what he did was an amazing job of melding the operations with the analysis into things that are, it's why it has such a legacy for us.
That's really some great insight. I know it often comes up in classrooms where students will ask, what is the role of academia when it comes to developing some of these things? And I think it's interesting to see the routes that people take when they move their careers forward.
Yes, Randy, I didn't know I was going to get involved in structured techniques until somebody asked me to teach a one-hour class as I was walking. I had just retired from CIA. I was walking down the hall, and he says, can you just help us out for a couple months? And then that got me into this course, and then the runner of the course, Jack Davis, disappeared or went somewhere else, and they said, well, can you run the course? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I've got another job, but I can do it part-time, or I can try to find some time to do it. And then that got me into developing the first purple book on structured techniques. And it's just from there on, it kind of blossomed, should we say. And I found that a niche that worked pretty well to keep pushing to work on the structured techniques and the cognitive biases and these other issues.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see how people fall into what they're doing. Unless there's any other questions in the chat, you could probably move on to the next component of your discussion, and I'll keep monitoring as we go.
Well, actually, I think I finished it up. Yes, so I've covered all the key themes that I wanted to pull out of the book.
So Randy, since you've got a lot of your books up here, can you just kind of go through some of them and say, you know, if somebody's interested in X, you know, you might want to consider taking a look at Analyst Guide to Indicators or so on to provide a little bit of perspective to some of the people in the room today?
Well, these are all the books that have some tie or Dick has either co-authored or what he's done is reflected in these books. The Structural Analytical Techniques book on the top there is our Bible, or people tell us it's their Bible, I should put it that way, which is 55 techniques. We looked at around 600, and we came up with 50, 55 that are relevant, directly relevant to doing solid analysis. We used to say it was an intelligence analysis, but we really have broadened it out to analytical thinking writ large. And when we rewrite the book, or I'm going to do that this fall, I think we're going to have some how to organize and conceptualize get started group. Then we're going to go into the creative imagination innovation group. Then we're going to have a diagnostic techniques like ACH and key assumptions check. Then we'll move to the reframing techniques. And what we've done over time is try to eliminate the contrarian or the challenge, those concepts of how to have a family of techniques that does that, which is where I started at CIA 15 years ago, and we taught that aggressively. But we found that when we taught the challenge techniques, people got really emotionally involved in them, and they were almost counterproductive. They built deeper mindsets almost all the time instead of making you more stand back and reflective. Then we have the foresight techniques, and then the last section we're going to have are decision support tools. Because if you're going to use the techniques, you still need to bring them to ground as to how do you apply them and what are you doing. So that's the SAT book. The other thing we're going to do is a lot more work mapping cognitive biases to specific techniques and vice versa. what kinds of techniques are most effective in dealing with that particular bias or that intuitive trap. So that's what's on my agenda for the fall. The Critical Thinking for Strategic Intelligence is work that my wife and I, we co-wrote the book. She did half and I did half. But the thing we find most intriguing is that we go back and we ask somebody, well, which chapters did she write and which did I write? And nobody can figure it out. We actually, on two chapters, we couldn't remember who wrote them. So we had a pretty good mind meld. The way she organized that book, actually we organized it on the plane heading to Chile to go do a workshop. We had a lot of downtime, where the 40 questions she was asked when she was teaching fusion centers how to develop an analytical unit and how to do the analytical process. And almost all these people were said, poof, you're an analyst. And they said, well, what do I do if I'm poof, an analyst? How does this happen? What is required of me? So we put that into four sections of the getting started phase, which everybody tends to skip over, which is the most important. Then the data gathering and research phase. Then not compiling your data and organizing it, but actually building an argument using your brain, and I say not your fingers, and developing an argument. And lastly, how do you present it effectively? So we worked our way through those four areas, and there are a lot of things in there where we make direct reference to Dick and his work. The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis is a book many people have seen or used, and that's old. So we're at the stage now where I will be rewriting that also this year with a colleague, Welton Chang, who works at Tetlock at University of Pennsylvania, and he is also in contact with Kahneman. He had an astounding comment for me, is that he looked at Kahneman's Fast and Slow book, and he said, based upon our current understanding of the psychological bias and cognitive bias literature today, about a third of Kahneman's book is wrong. And he told Kahneman that is outdated or is incorrect in terms of the analysis he had in Fast and Slow. So you think that would be problematic, but it turns out that the reason it's wrong is that it was based on small sample size. And Kahneman's response was, well, the number one problem that I identified when I wrote Fast and Slow was the problem of small sample size. So I was just predicting I'd be wrong. So I'm very happy with what you found. So everybody breathed a sigh of relief, and we're going to actually try to make that point when we rewrite the book. The Handbook of Tools and Techniques is a kind of a classroom version of 24 techniques that we, and it's really a how-to. We made it ugly and purple so that it doesn't get lost on your desk. The Analyst Guide to Indicators is work that we've done. Actually, my co-author there is John Pyrick, who ran the analytical training programs for the Canadians for CSIS. And he just retired, which gave me an opportunity to grab some of his expertise. And we published that 3 or 4 months ago as kind of the definitive guide for how to think about indicators, both in a law enforcement context and also in a estimative national intelligence process. And then the last one is one I enjoy the most. Ruben Arcos and I co-edited this book based upon the conference we had at ISA, looking at how do you package and deliver analysis in a digital format. And one of the big ahas there was actually from A to Z, you have to rethink your process of how you research, what you look for, how you organize the data, and how you present it. And in the book we have several authors from Spain, Canada, the United States, all contributing chapters on how to think about these issues and how to rethink and maybe revolutionize, and I think in a very positive way, how you can generate and produce higher quality analysis when you move to the digital format. Just one comment on that, which I like, is, for example, if you have an icon, it's a key assumptions icon, you just click on it, and you know that if you're writing your article or doing your presentation, you can at least accompany the article with two or three of your underlying assumptions. If the reader cares, they can click on it. If they don't care, they never have to read it. You can do the same thing on key information gaps. So you can have a lot of backstopping on what is the rigor of how you're producing your analysis that you can work into the product digitally. And it will then give people a much better sense of what you're doing. And with the, again, your sourcing, you could have a source summary statement. You could have a lot of things that just pull rigor in because you know you have those boxes. You could even have a box that shows what SATs did I use and how did I use them, which what I like is that the reader or the recipient can totally ignore or can click on the ones that they care about and it allows you to be a much more effective presenter of good analysis. So that's a quick run through, but we again pulled through some of Hoyer's cognitive ideas in the communicating intelligence communication in the digital age.
Yeah, and Randy, that last one, the intelligence communication in the digital age, I know I've spoken with Ruben about the book, and we've kind of thrown around some ideas about the potential for doing some simulation work between across classes or maybe even across universities based off of some of the stuff that's in there. So I think that there's a lot of room for testing some things out and having fun with it. I wanted to note, George has asked in the chat, given the small groups that you advocate, how can these best be integrated into a world of large fusion centers with the need to share and avoid stovepiping without losing the essence of the small group?
Well, maybe 2 points I would make there. One is that you, no matter how large the function is, if you're working on a paper or a project, you really have two choices. You assign it to somebody and you think that's efficient and they do all the work. Then you realize that they got it half wrong or they were caught by biases or whatever. So if you're looking at getting a project done, if you have two or three people, generally I say my ideal group size is three people. Have them engage with each other very effectively in the conceptual phases of the project, particularly at the start. And then maybe if you do a key assumptions or a pre-mortem halfway through it, you're looking at evaluation of it at the end. Not everybody has to do the research, but you can have the lead analyst who's doing a lot of the work. But by making it more of a group process, you're going to catch your bad assumptions, you're going to reduce your mitigate your biases in what you're doing, and you're going to have a much richer place to draw from in terms of your data and your experiences. That said, so I say keep it as a small group and then make it purely project-oriented. The groups are only, you've got a mission to perform, you've got a paper to write or a briefing to put together, a strategic plan to develop, and whoever's going to do it, or that's your core group. The other thing I've learned over the years and work I did for the DNI is that if you're trying to build corporate sense of what's going on and more collaborative efforts, don't expect that you can build a collaborative team of more than maybe eight people. And there's just so many people that you can actually trust, and you can't trust 35 people. And if you're going to collaborate, you really need to be able to trust the people that you're collaborating with as part of a group effort. And I define collaboration as saying that you're willing to demonstrate or manifest your vulnerabilities to other people, because that's where you're insecure, you have it right. You want to see if they have a way to think about it better, and how do you proceed? So if you can have large groups and people doing things, but when it gets down to actually generating products and performing against the task, try to keep those groups, try not to get it down to one, don't get it below three, and have them focused on purely on mission performance and trying to deal with some of these issues.
And I'm seeing some other comments in the chat, one from Joy. As an intelligence squadron commander, I'm always looking for ways to improve critical thinking and analysis for my airmen. And Joy, I think that's also true for all of us that work in academia as well. We're always trying to improve the critical thinking processes of our students as well. So I think that's largely a thing across the board. If you guys have any questions in the chat, now is the time. So please go ahead and type in your remaining burning questions, and we'll have Randy take a stab at answering them.
I can give a reflection while people are contemplating more questions. With Joy, I'm thinking of the environment that she's in. One of our core techniques was that pre-mortem. And if you've got a functioning unit, one thing would be interesting is to sit down and say, where have we made mistakes, or where, more importantly, where have we had near misses, where we could have had a major mistake and we avoided it and we were lucky. And you can come up within your own unit with a list of four or five things. I've seen some unit chiefs who have taken a list of, we made these mistakes over the past 10 years in our unit, we don't want to make these mistakes again, and they put the list on the front door of the boss's office. And so every time anybody walks in to see the boss, they have to be reminded of the things they are not going to do wrong again. And so it makes another point that as you worry about these issues, you have to not take a list of 50 things that academically, theoretically could be done wrong. You need to focus on what will people in the unit actually pay attention to. If the list is too long, everyone will just ignore it. If it's too short, you've accomplished nothing. So the magic of how long a list would be of things we don't want to do wrong, like have we really checked our sourcing, have we, et cetera, it has to be something that is developed by the team itself, because only they're the only ones who know what their tolerance is for stopping and doing the checklist and using it. And it's totally pointless to have a checklist that is not calibrated to the needs. Another example of that is in surgical operations, surgeries. They now have Atul Gawande kind of got the ball started with his checklist manifesto and the work that he did there. But as you go into surgery, everybody's got a list. One of the things is you have to introduce yourself to everybody else on the team so everybody knows who's on the team. And I don't know why that works, but it apparently has pretty good impact on making sure that you have lower fatality rate in surgery. So the surgical procedures, they've only in the last 20 years, 15 years, have they gone to that checklist routine. And they developed it really from whole cloth. And they developed it in a way in which it wasn't being imposed by someone who says, these are the things you have to do. The teams have to develop their own checklists. And I found in a major bank, we did this where we had a list of what are the core things we need to consider before we start to write a paper. Like, where is the best source of information to get before you get on the computer? Who's got expertise or what other expertise do we need? How fast can we turn this paper around? What's reasonable? And what assumptions are we making about what the client's looking for in terms of length? So you have questions like that. And like we call it a huddle. And you'd have this huddle that could last 15 minutes or 5 minutes or an hour, depending upon what paper you're doing. And everybody found that with the managers and the contributors to the paper and the people who were stakeholders in getting the product out the door, that if they just took that short amount of time up front, they ended up with a much tighter, much better produced product. It was easier to write, and it was much quicker to move through processing and editing and review. And they basically got to the point where they refused to write papers without doing this, that they found the process that they developed themselves to be extremely efficient. And it was one of these things that people would walk in and they say, we're going to go have a huddle before we start this paper. And you'd learn that immediately and became part of your operating culture.
No, I think that that's some great final reflections, Randy. I think that there's a lot to be said about that pre-planning before you go off in your own different directions. And I know for the students in the room, it might be something that you guys also start to incorporate into your regular day-to-day tasks, especially as you come to start approaching your papers and then also as you start to think about dissertation topics. I know it's as it relates to these structured analytic techniques, you might also consider different areas that you can try applying them, so different fields. I know, Randy, I'm thankful that you actually brought up healthcare, since that's an often overlooked area where you can, in fact, apply a lot of these different kinds of techniques. So it gives the people in the room some additional food for thought. Well, it doesn't seem that we have any additional questions, so Randy, I want to really thank you for joining us today at the April Intel Hub, and we look forward to sharing with you how well this project moves forward throughout the rest of the year. And again, thank you for taking the time out and joining us. It was very, very insightful.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with some of the students and kind of kick some of these ideas around.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to see you back for our April or our May session where we're going to be hosting Arnold Roizer, who's going to talk to us about open source intelligence. All right, Randy, it was just us. It's us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Okay, I hope that worked all right.
Yeah, I hope you felt comfortable doing this. I mean, I think it went very smoothly, so thanks so much for being a willing participant. And if you're interested, let me know. I can shoot you emails of the next sessions if you want to join as a participant moving forward. We're always welcome to have you and your colleagues as well.
Yes, I would be interested in that. So keep me in the loop.
Will do. I'll make sure that I add you to the list, and when you start getting irritated, just tell me to take you off.
Okay. That won't happen, I'm sure.
All right. Have a good one, Randy, and thanks again.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.